Oh. Hello.
Hello, vegetables. This is Neil here, right? Look, I don't want to spoil the whole record for you, right, before it's even begun, but I just wanted to say that the whole thing was quite a lot of hassle to make, right? And it didn't turn out like I expected it at all. I mean, for a start, there's just much too much technology and commercial stuff on it, right? And it's far too... Oh no, here we go.
Hello, shoes. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to stand on you again.
Oh, wow. What a horrible dream I just had.
This is Edith O'Connor, Anatomy of a Song, Nigel Planer,
Neil holding my shoe.
I looked in the sky where an elephant's eye was looking at me from a bubblegum tree. And all that I knew was the hole in my shoe, which was letting in water. Letting in water. Letting in water.
Oh no, what a really heavy bummer.
I walked through a field that just wasn't real, with 100 tin soldiers that stood at my shoulders.
Welcome to Adiosography and an Anatomy on a Song episode that might cater more to a UK audience, but hopefully there should be enough of interest to all. I want to speak to Nigel Planer for two reasons. One, because I'm a big Young Ones fan. I thought it'd be a fascinating subject for an Anatomy of a Song, where you got an actor playing a character singing songs. It's a different approach. It'd be of interest, I thought. And secondly, my eldest child always comes in when I'm editing, and he'll say, "Oh, who did you interview? Was it somebody famous?" And I'd always have to say, "Nobody you know." So it was nice to be able to get someone that could say, "Oh, guess who I'm interviewing?" So that was a part of it. So he's at the beginning of the chat, because he wanted to say hi and ask a question. There's another one coming up that's inspired by another family member. It's nice to be able to do that. Also, apologies in advance, because the connection wasn't great for the interview. I've edited around it as best I can. I will be upgrading for future interviews, so some more costs, but I think necessary. But it was a really fun chat with Nigel. Really enjoyed it. So enjoy the conversation with Nigel Planer, aka Neil Whedon Watkins Pie.
Vegetable rights and peas.
The interview starts now.
This is my son Arthur. He's also a big fan.
Hi.
So hello. Basically, he's the same age now I was when I first watched Young Ones. So he's nearly 11. Right. And I was nearly 11 when I first watched Young Ones.
And what year would that have been, though?
82.
Oh, right. So when it first came out?
Yeah.
Well, you weren't watching repeats. You were watching...
No. I remember when it first came out.
Right, I can see.
You can see us now. Do you have any questions for Nigel?
When did you do the first episode?
Oh, I was talking about that. I remembered it wrongly. I thought, because we did all the series, the outdoor bits, in Bristol. But somebody told me last week that, in fact, it was in London. The outdoor bit of that original house, the one that gets blown up in the first episode, was in London. was in London. I can't remember whereabouts. But the indoor bits were always down in the studio in the BBC.
Right.
So what was the gap between doing the pilot and the actual second episode of the series then? What was the, in terms of like a few months, was it?
About 8 months. And it was all because Channel 4 was about to open. It's now the 40th anniversary, and Channel 4, and so the BBC were by the thought that the Channel 4 was going to be opening with the comic strip. So they were both kind of incomplete, and we happened to be in both series, but all opening at the same time.
Are you disappointed? Hasn't got the long dark hair.
Yeah, sorry about the hair.
That's fine.
It's only 40 years ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
It was a wig then. It wasn't even real hair then. It was just a wig.
Really? It was a wig?
Yeah.
Well, there's an episode where it flies off. He's going,
oh, yeah.
Oh, no, it was a wig after all, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. I never knew I wore a wig.
Was it just one of those things where you just put it over your head?
You had like a hair net, didn't you? To cover your actual hair.
You put a, to do a wig, yeah, you have to put a sort of tight thing over your, like a stocking top over your head. Then you put the wig on. And then it's got all these bits of lace, but the hairs are actually individually knotted in. And then there's lace that comes down. If you want to check them out when you're watching telly, it's easy to tell who's wearing a wig because you look not at the, don't look at the bit where you'd think see the joint. The place to look is sort of about there, like that, across there. And you can see because it's invisible lace that they've put down that the hair's attached to. And then they glue it down. So if you see a little line of
right now.
Yeah. If you see a little line of puckered skin like that.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, kind of like a wrinkle.
Oh, yeah, he's looking right now. You can see that wrinkle, Benny?
Yeah, sort of. It's kind of like a ditch here.
That's right. You can see the lace line usually about there.
Yeah, maybe.
But, I mean, if you watch, once you notice that, I've just ruined...
You just ruined the entire Young Ones experience.
Telly. Well, not just Young Ones, but all telly.
All telly, yeah. Thank you, Nigel.
Yeah, that wig's pretty good because we hid it with the hair down. We did a lot, but if you look at some of those period dramas, you can sometimes just, once you know how it's done, you just think, how are they getting away with that? That looks ridiculous.
Yeah, it just ruins it for you.
Around with hair, you know.
Do you want to say bye then? I can carry on the interview.
Yeah. It was nice meeting you. I really like this. It's really funny.
Oh, excellent! Great. Have you seen all 12?
He's seen all 12.
Yeah.
My wife's got one friend, so I'm trying to like kind of. It's a bit of a yin and yang thing, kind of like a to and fro between friends and Young Ones. You prefer Young Ones? Yeah, but you don't say that, do you?
No, honestly, I do. It's more fun.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, so I want to get a sense of before the Young Ones, because looking at the DVD and the documentary on the DVD, I didn't realise that you had Neil as a character already fully formed before the Young Ones. So I realised that Rick had his Rick the poet character.
1976 was, we did a show called Rank, myself and Peter Richardson, the comic strip guy. And Neil was just a small part in it. In fact, I wanted to cut it because in the rehearsals before we went to the first night in Plymouth, I said, oh, it's not, that didn't work. You know, nobody's laughing at it. Or the band aren't laughing anymore. And Peter said, because they've seen it so often. No, good. And it went down really well. So he stayed in the show and became the most popular thing in the show, really.
So what was the initial idea of Neil?
It was based, the show was based on the Windsor Pop Festival. Peter and I met at Glastonbury, the first Glastonbury. It was either the first or the second Glastonbury. And we went to the Windsor Festival, and by then, 73 or 4, he got taken down by the police. They were pretty crap, these festivals. A lot of people shouting for the mic, grabbing the mic, claiming they were sort of living alternative community lifestyle. And really, you know, that's how I feel about Glastonbury in a way. I think it's like the BBC without a roof on. They have about 400... Start, and everyone makes out their, you know, living on the land. Or and at the Windsor Festival, there was some really bad acts. There was folk singers, and the idea for Neil was, you know, somebody who for some reason, arrogance or something, has come on stage with a guitar and knows he's crap, but he comes out and says, you know, I'm going to do some songs for you, they're pretty bad actually. He can't present himself, he can't play, he can't sing, can't do it. But he still persists, says, you know, I'm going to do this, they're both bad, I'm going to do the first one, the worst one first, second one won't seem so bad. And then that was his act, that was Neil's sort of act. And then he sang this appalling song, which he had to work out. And it was just a sort of piss take of all the sort of acts you got in the festival. And Neil then turned into solo act. And then we went to the Comedy Store and then the Comic Strip. And we were then working with Nail. And so it became, we all sort of brought our characters.
Yeah, so he wasn't specifically a hippie at first then?
No, he wasn't sort of the kind of you've got to have loons and you've got to have long hair and you've got all of that. That was a bit of a sort of Ben Elton imposition on him to some extent. I said, oh, he's got to have long hair, but he's got to be one of those kind of studenty guys who's cut it there, so straight across. They made this wig, but they said, we'll cut it when we fit it. And the day we fitted it, it just looked so exactly right. It was the new wig.
Yeah.
That is just perfect.
You know? Yeah, yeah. So you found the character at that moment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we all really had the character, the look. We found the look. Yes.
Yeah. So when did you first hear about the actual sitcom being an actual thing that was going to be made, that Neil was going to be part of?
Well, we were all working together in the comic strip, and we put proposals forward for... We did Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, which was a stand-up comedy show with all the various acts. And then we thought we need a show that's kind of ours, in-house. So we invented a kind of, you know, that comic where you can slice the front of the house. Is it Desperate Dan or something, where you've got all the little cartoons? And I can't remember, there was a director who was going to make that. And each of our acts was going to be in a different room in this house. But that nothing ever came of that. And then Rick and his girlfriend Lisa at the time came up with the idea of making them students and making them in a with Alexia the landlord. You know, that was the idea, basically. And they sort of claimed that moment and got Ben Elton, and proposed it to the BBC, to the guy who'd done Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, Paul Jackson. And yes, it got made. It had to transfer from, I mean, I think the old comedy department, the old Oxbridge comedy department didn't know what to make of it. So we went to Variety, where the budgets were bigger anyway. How come we had the bands in? So we could qualify for...
That was the genius move, wasn't it? The idea of making it, putting a band in, making it Variety, and you get longer to make it and you get a bigger budget. That was genius.
Get a bigger budget and you can do the special effects then, because we used to do an extra day's, we got an extra day's filming from a normal sitcom. Normally you'd have a day, the outdoor stuff beforehand, then record in the studio, one studio audience, rehearse, go in. But we had a pre-day in the studio, drowning, explosions, putting a pickaxe through your head, whatever, all of that stuff. Those were little inserts, special effects inserts, played in on the day. And that gave it the extra excitement, I think.
So what amazed me about making of was the actual sound effects, like Vivian hitting Rick, would be done live there and then, so the studio audience would hear that sound as well.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. I can't remember the name of the sound guy. I think it was... Was it Laurie? Can't remember the name. Yes, pretty good. Like old-fashioned literal slapstick.
Yeah.
Slapstick was a stick that you'd slap together when someone smacked someone, and you had to coordinate them so you both did it at the same time. So it's pretty impressive, except all he'd be doing is going sound effect.
Yeah.
But more like a theatre.
Exactly each time is...
Yeah.
Quite,
more like a theatre experience. So.
Yeah. So Peter Richardson was originally going to be Mike, and it's alluded to in the documentary that Peter Jackson mentions.
Which documentary you brought up?
It's the one that's on the Young Ones DVD. It's the Making of the Young Ones.
Oh, right. I didn't know that was on there.
The fact that there was some kind of argument about it. Sorry, it's Paul Jackson, isn't it?
Yeah, Paul Jackson.
Were you privy to that argument and to why he didn't end up playing the part of Mike?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much an argument as a sort of process. And, Peter was producing the comic strip. It's kind of old news. It's an old story now. He was my double act partner. There was the two double acts and Alexi. That was the nexus. And Peter hadn't got on with Paul when we did Boom Boom Out Go the Lights. He was pretty pissed off with him for not including him in the first Boom Boom Out Go the Lights. And then he's very, very controlling in terms of wanting it you know, he's got the artistic vision. He's got it. He's got it how he wants. And of course, his way of doing things was not a very, you know, Paul Jackson was a light entertainment producer. And so Peter and, you know, light entertainment and Peter didn't. He's not very kind of, he wouldn't have done the, you know, the big smiley faces or the loud performance for the audience. Mm. He used to make movies, single camera filming, you know, that's what he's good at. So there was a bit of a, not so much an argument, but a disjoint, I think you'd call it now, between what was realistic, what was a realistic thing going to happen. I'm not even sure if they'd said, do you want to play it, and then he would have, he probably would have, because you wouldn't say no, but maybe not.
We never got the stage where we actually started rehearsing or actually doing the...
No, we never got anywhere near that. It was just like, oh, there's this thing we're going to do, and the discussions about who's going to be in it. And it appeared to be written tailor-made for us, but in the same way as, you know, he'd written a character called Neil for me, the sort of bullying of Neil, you know, that, oh, Neil, does anyone ever listen to anything you say? That's the kind of Ben Elton interpretation of the character that I was already doing.
All right, okay.
You see what I mean? Yeah. So Ben's contribution was pretty strong like that. And so his interpretation of Peter's character was a slight misfire as well. It wasn't quite... Peter was a bit... Peter's persona in the Outer Limits, in the double act, was a bit cooler than mine. Not like the guy who's trying to be the cool guy.
Yeah.
Peter was the cool guy.
Was the cool guy, okay.
I mean, he wasn't like... He wasn't acting that kind of guy going... Our double act worked because he was the cool. He looked pretty good and he'd always sort of look up at me with disdain. And I'm a lot taller than him. And I'd sort of clown about and look like an idiot. And that's how it worked. So I don't think he would have worked as Mike. It worked much better having Chris disciplining us. You know, I watched it again recently. He's so strict, you know, he just shouts, isn't it? You know, stop that, do this, you know.
He's effectively the straight man to three comedians. Yeah.
He holds it all together, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, without him, I think it might fall apart.
It doesn't work, yeah. So I look in the YouTube comments when I do these Anatomy of a Song episodes to see what they say about the songs and that. And then somebody made a very good point about the Young Ones. I'll try to read out. It says, why has nobody mentioned that Mike represented the 50s, Neil the 60s, Vivian the 70s, and Rick the 80s? Seems obvious to me. Do you buy that? Because that makes sense to me. Do you think that was... Was that just a fortuitous thing that it seems that way, or do you think there's something in that?
In terms of their clothes, yeah.
Their image, and yeah.
I suppose, yeah, in terms of their image, yeah.
That clearly wasn't a conscious thing then.
No, I never sort of thought. I think of it more as like a nuclear family with you know, Rick and Aid as the arguing kids, and yes. Mike and Neil as the mum and dad, you know.
As the housewife, yeah. Getting the lentils on, yeah.
Moaning and complaining all the time, you know. But yes, actually, I suppose in the wardrobe department, wardrobe and hair, that's true in a way, isn't it?
I'd never thought that until I read that comment.
No, that's quite good.
So the secret to playing Neil, because I think one of the hardest things to do in comedy is do absolute deadpan, underplay deadpan, which you did brilliantly as Neil. I think that's why Neil's my favourite character, and also Arthur's as well. It's just that, I don't know what the line is, where he says, like, if I had a penny for every time I had to open the door, I'd have £2.46, yeah. Whatever. And just the absolute deadpan way you say it is what makes it so funny.
If I had a penny for every time I had to answer the door, I'd have £5.63.
Was there a secret to playing Neil? Was there a technique you had?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, that thing about legs swimming very hard under the water and you don't see it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that because, you know, I am and I was an actor, quite, you know, play all sorts of role. But it depends what show you're in and who you're with. And so with Neil, there's an awful lot of reacting. You know, how do I score a point? You know, or I even make my presence felt up against, because he's so over the top. There's so much noise and fuss. you know, such a big amount of energy, just the amount of energy. So it's not, I'll never be able to put out as much energy as he's.
That much, yeah.
And also I couldn't use my height, and that I've got a slightly gentler voice. And you start sort of, you know, there's a lot of work goes on under the surface of how can I best, you know, draw attention, undermine what he's doing, or compliment. I mean, undermine's the nasty way.
Yeah.
And compliment is the nice way. And I think it works really well. If you've got somebody doing shout, making all this noise, somebody else just stands completely still behind and then goes, really? It makes good, you know, the jazz of it, the music of it is good. So an awful lot was sort of inflicted on me by the amount of energy, the rig and a...
Yes.
Shoving out all this energy. So what could you do in that? But to sort of go, I don't know, and just sort of play it down. And it works. I think it underpins really well what they're doing. That scene with the exams is really, I mean, it's beautifully written by Ben Elton, but it just works so well. The two of us, he's saying, go on, test me on my lines. And I'm just taking everything literally, he said. It's the rhythm of it is very good, you know. So the playing is like in a band, isn't it? You wouldn't make that noise if you were solo.
Crop rotation in the 14th century was considerably more widespread after... God, I know this. Don't tell me. After 1172. No, but I didn't think it was important. You just said not to tell you.
I did not! I bloody well did not!
You did. You said don't tell me just before you said 1172.
Yes, but I only meant for a minute.
What, a minute from now or a minute from then?
Look, just shut up and tell me the answer.
Shut up and tell you the answer.
Just tell me the answer!
John.
Thank you.
John. Yeah, John is the answer. Crop rotation in the 14th century was considerably more widespread after John Lloyd invented the patent crop rotator.
Oh, yes! I knew it! I bloody knew it!
You didn't. You said 1172. That's not a bit like John.
You spike-on little bastard, Neil!
Yeah, was there a moment during the first series where you realised this is really taking off, or was it not until later on? I mean, it seems to me like the second series was huge. The anticipation before, I remember, was a big deal, whereas the first series, like a gradual thing. I can remember as a kid, like everyone talked about it at school the next day. It was like this big new thing you've discovered as kids. There's like a, I don't know if there's a kid sitcom for adults or an adult sitcom for kids, but it was like this,
yeah.
It seemed like a gradual thing in the first season series. I said season, I shouldn't say season, should I? I think being a British sitcom. Was there a moment when you thought, wow, this is really taking off here?
Yeah, I didn't realize how important, you know, how many people you reach in one moment with telly. They didn't have big ratings to begin with. I mean, what we might call big ratings now. Mm. It was always sort of under 2 million at the beginning, but that's in the days when a successful comedy show would get 15 million, you know. And I suppose it gathered momentum. It was a phenomenon, wasn't it? I can't really remember, to tell you the truth.
It wasn't a moment when somebody recognised you in the street and you thought, well, something's going on here. I don't normally get this much attention when I'm walking to the shop to get a paper.
No, really. I mean, it happened because we were already on a roll. The comic strip was already, it was such an exciting period, and we were already, it was getting recognition in London where I lived from the club. And then what did surprise me, I think, was how suddenly you've gone mainstream with telly, whether you like it or not. You're playing to millions of people. I can't remember a particular moment. It was over that year, I suppose.
Okay, so it's a gradual thing. So was there a big difference between making the second series to the first in terms of, I don't know, maybe the working dynamics within the group or just how it felt?
We got better. I think, you know, we got... And the second series, you know, moved in. No, it's not as good as the first. When the first one, they ignored it. No, obviously, we knew all along that this was brilliant. And this one isn't as good, you know. But I think we got better. It got slicker. We got better at working with each other, and it got less you know, less choppy. But on the other hand, I saw it again the other day, the first episode, and the complete sort of crack is what is so amazing about it, isn't it? That, you know, the way it's edited, the way it's performed, it's like so crude and crap. You know, it's not slickly done at all.
It's punk, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, and that was the idea. And so maybe we were right to stop after the two series, because it would have all got more and more like, as you were saying, like Friends or something.
Yeah.
You could see when you see Friends, you can see them all waiting for the other person's laugh. Then they get it. Or something, Friends once, where somebody had taken the laugh track. Have you ever seen that? It's a video that's going around on YouTube. Somebody had taken the laugh track off. And you realise how slick and professional they are. You know, they're delivering a line. And then they're reacting, and you're thinking, yes, yes. And then they say the next line, and the other person goes and reacts. There's all these long, long pauses, and that's where the laughter's in there.
Tell her she's not marriage material. What? Girls say it to me all the time. Believe me, if she's anything like me, she's just going to be relieved.
How do I tell Chandler that it's too soon? It's going to break his heart. He's going to think I don't love him anymore.
Well, you don't.
Yes, I do. Good, I was just testing you. Oh, hi. You know, we were just talking about bacon.
That's a good question, actually, because I remember John Cleese talking about Fawlty Towers, about not waiting for the laugh to die down, because, you know, the microphones will pick it up anyway, and their fast is so go at a certain pace.
Yeah.
The Young Ones, was there a case of you having to be aware of the laughter and react to it, or would you just work as if there was no laughter and you were just working
We're in the Cleese camp. If you're in a live situation, you want to try, as the just hit them before, just as it's about to die, you want to go, boom, and then you're surfing the next wave.
Yeah.
Whereas if you wait for it all to die, which it looks like on Friends they're doing, it never kicks you hard enough in the, you know, for my enjoyment. I'm with Cleese on that.
Yeah.
Wait until it's peaking and then kick it again and don't give up on it, you know. And we were doing that, but it did mean that's what something that was criticised for in the second series. It said, oh, they're using canned laughter now. They've had to put laughter in. This is so funny, they're having to put canned laughter in. What was happening was we were getting so many laughs and riding that phenomenon you're talking about is riding the laugh, not waiting for it to die. We were riding them so hard that the person in the sound booth was having to go with the volume and turn the laughter out. Otherwise, you wouldn't at home hear the next line.
Right.
So it sounded like canned laughter. You were getting the real live audience laughing. Ha, 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 whoop, and it would be turned off because so it was the opposite of what the critic was saying. Critic was saying, this is so unfunny, they've put some canned laughter on it. But in fact, we were having to turn the laughter off because we were riding it hard, you know.
Yeah, because the pace, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that ended in June, and then July, Hole in My Shoe comes out. So what was the initial idea to do a Neil single then? Where did that first come from?
To be honest, it came from a bloke called Alan McGowan, an old friend of mine. He's a rock promoter, writer, and he used to run a club called Wits End Comedy Club. And we played it, and I made friends with him. And it was him who said, he said, you should do a single of Hole in My Shoe. I mean, it's as simple as that. It was just his idea. And he said, and I've got the very band to do it with. I'll put you in touch with Marillion. And Hole in My Shoe with Marillion. So we went down that path a bit, and it didn't come together with Marillion. They were on tour, or they didn't like the idea, or I don't know why.
Give us an M. Give us an A. Give us an R. This is going to take ages, right? Because it's a really long word. Did I do R? Give us an R. Give us an I double L I. Give us An I-O-N. What's that smell? What's that smell? What's that smell? Yes, it's it's Marilyn. No. Oh, what? It's Marillion.
And so somebody was in touch with Dave Stewart. So I went round to him and his little flat, and he played me his tapes from... He used to have a band called Rapid Eye Movement, R.E.M. Not the R.E.M. It's strange career he's got, because he's not the Dave Stewart as in the...
No, he's not the R.E.M. Did he sue them?
And he's not R.E.M. Did he sue them? I don't know this history of this. I don't know. You're saying he did sue them?
I'm asking if he did, because, I mean, why wouldn't you, eh?
But... So very strange that he would have sort of two occurrences of having your own name abused, or, you know, someone else using it. He must be so tired of saying, no, not the REM, no, not the Data Good. He must be really tired of it.
Yeah.
He made a demo for me, and I just thought, this is absolutely brilliant. He's a sort of producer extraordinaire. So we did it with him. And in Cambridge, what were they called? Studio. Spacewood Studios, and he spent ages building up all the right drum sounds and everything. He knew how to make a record, but also putting in so many references in it, just a little bit of Beatles, a bit of this, isn't it? There's a little bit of Small Faces he puts in a phrase there. You know, he really layers it in. And we tried it, doing it just as if it was real Neil. So I came in character. I mean, I used to be a singer, so I could have sung it properly. And we tried it as just Neil's voice. And Neil obviously is crap, and he wouldn't be able to sing. Well, that's quite funny for the first 10 seconds. You wouldn't want to listen to 3 minutes of that. Yeah. So we tried it, and I sang it as well as I could, really nicely. You just think, well, why am I listening to this? It's not Neil, it's not funny. And so we worked, you know, a fair bit to get it to sound like Neil, but pleasant, you know, well sung enough, Neil. And so it's got character. Now, it wasn't that easy to get exactly the right tone, singing-wise. And I think we did. And then there's a bit at the end when they do the where we thought, well, now we've done it. Let's sing like real Neil. And he sings completely out of tune. And that's quite fun.
So I never thought about that, actually. So it says kind of like a halfway house between how Neil would actually sound properly sung. So it's kind of like a nice version of Neil, effectively.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble with the comedy and music in records often is one of them will win. Comedy, if you're getting a laugh, it was a surprise. Whereas music, you want to repeat, you want to hear, you have a feeling, it stirs you, it does something else to you. And they can destroy each other. You know, the good music can make something unfunny. And too funny, just be not interesting musically. And this was where Dave really understood what I was on about, and what we tried to achieve was to make something that would be satisfying musically. And I think we did. I mean, it was quite a lot of work on the album. Like, I don't know if you've heard the album, but yes, there's Dave's version of, well, I said Dave's version, Dave and, you know, it's Neil's version of Hurdy Gurdy Man by Donovan. And that's actually...
It's a really good version, actually, yeah.
Really good. Yeah. Listen to it again recently. No, that's the way he swirls the sounds into it, and then you suddenly hear Neil's voice very high up. No, it's Neil. and then it gets silly and boggier and funnier, but it's actually really quite moving, the way he's done that. Oh, think we, with the album, it kind of toys between trying to be funny.
Ew. What's that smell? Have you farted?
Trying to be musical, but I think the music has to win it, yeah. If you're going to listen to a whole album.
And it just doesn't sound nice, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, Dave could bring in the right mob who were of mine and Neil's musical taste, playing on it, the album, and the singer. We had Jacko Jackson, who's now the lead guitarist singer of King Crimson. We had Dick Lyle, who's passed away. We had just got written them all down because there's so many amazing musos he called in. We had Bryson Graham, who's also passed away, who was the drummer of Spooky Tooth. Mental Nightmare.
Mental Nightmare is insane. I was going to ask you about that. We'll get to that.
That's cool. Yeah. We had Jimmy Hastings. We had Rick Bidoff, the bass player from Spira Gyra, and a proper bunch of mostly Canterbury, you know, the caravan sound, playing on Neil's album.
I mean, if you listen to an instrumental version of the album, it's not a comedy album, is it?
Jimmy, not really, no. I mean, it's not a comedy album. It's an album which got, for some reason, given Neil this chance. It's quite a strange piece, but of late, it got re-released by Esoteric Records in 2014. And since then, it's had quite a lot of, music mag, music website, a lot of people writing. You know, it's not like a little TV spin-off.
No, exactly.
No, it's an amazing piece of music, really.
Yeah, definitely. So back to Hole in My Shoe. Was a video made for it? I don't recall ever. Why was there not a video made when you got a TV character, an actor singing the song? It seems like it's perfectly set up to make a video for it. Was there just no budget or no inclination?
Well, I think there was a BBC, it wasn't what you call a video, but BBC sort of breakfast team said, well, let's just go out to the playground and we'll just film you a bit. And it's not a video. I think the reason was that to make a video in those days was expensive. You know, 60 grand, 20, I don't know, a lot of money. And they thought, well, if we have to spend that money, are we going to make it back? Because we're taking a chance. We don't know what the hell this is. This is Neil from a comedy series doing Hole in My Shoe. This may be a complete disaster. So they didn't in advance put the money in to video. And then it went to the top of the chart so quickly that they thought, oh, we don't have to now. It's already happened.
I didn't realize it went straight in at number 5, which is incredibly rare. I mean, for a new artist, technically speaking, to go straight in at number 5, that's insane.
That was a big prize and a moment. And it then went to number 2 and stayed there.
For 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Oh,
do you remember the songs that were number 1 and number 3 for those 3 weeks? It was the same 2 songs.
It was Frankie Goes to Hollywood. It was Relax and the other one.
And 2 Tribes, yeah. And you're right, Sam was right between the two of them. That's amazing.
I managed to bring 2 Tribes down to 3. But Relax just number 1. So I was sandwiched between Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
That's not a bad top 3, is it?
Yeah, they're great. That was very exciting.
It was also Top of the Pops.
Oh no, where am I? Oh no, I must be on Top of the Pops. Heavy.
The first time I was on Top of the Pops, I remember it watching it as a kid. I think it's one of the few genuinely funny Top of the Pops performances. And you can tell it's funny because the kids in the audience are laughing.
I am on Top of the Pops. Oh, this is amazing. Hey, I'm going to get in the bath. My shoes on, right, because it won't make any difference. Oh, brilliant! Oh, wow, I just thought I might even meet Lulu. Yeah!
Like when you hit yourself with a microphone and fall back.
hang on. Made of paper. That's really hit. Look, a lot of trees have had to die to make those flowers, right? That's really heavy. Oh, is that it? Can I do the visa?
and a bit about listen to the lyrics, Paul Weller.
Listen to the lyrics, Paul Weller.
Was anybody trying to be funny on Top of the Pops? Anybody trying to be funny?
You'd get comedy songs all the time, wouldn't you? You get like, there'd be lots of hits, like there's a Roy Bremner one, or
Alexis. Was it?
Yeah, he did one of like cricket. And then the 19 not out as a spoof of 19.
In 1933, the England captain's average was 35. In 1984, it was 19. Then 19. 19. Then 19. 19.
19. 19. 19.
19. 19. 19.
Good. Remember that one? Blimey.
No.
Around that just weren't particularly.
Yeah, no, you're right, because there was a. I got a Brit award, and there was a comedy in the Brits. There was a comedy record
which you won. I was going to ask you about that.
So there must have been. Yeah, there must have been. Roland Rat, that's who it was.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, can you remember the other four nominees? Because Roland Rat was one of them.
Mel Brooks.
I had that single as well. My name is Adolf. I'm on the mic. I'm going to hip you to the story of the new Third Reich.
I think Alexi was one of them.
And there's one more.
Mel Brooks. Roland Rat.
Very random question.
No, you've got it there. Go on, tell us.
Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, yeah.
It was Michael Jackson spoofs.
What was he doing? Filler or something?
Eat It, I think it was.
Eat It, that's right. Just eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. I like his version of Tacky. That's a bit more recent. I'm so tacky.
I don't know that one.
Instead of happy. It's a really good video.
Okay, right. With my bells, with suspenders and sandals, with my socks. Got some new glitter rugs and lovely pink sequin crocs. Never let you forget some favor I did for you. If you're okay with that, you might just be tacky too. Where is your Brit right now? Do you still have it?
Storage. It wasn't a very exciting thing.
Not many actors can say they've got a Brit. You can say you might have a Tony or an Emmy, or you might have a...
Or even a BAFTA. I haven't got any of them.
No, you've got a Brit there, right? That's cool.
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
And the best comedy record is Hole in My Shoe. Yeah.
There's one surprise, Nigel Planer, the actor, of course, who plays the part of Neil, his own creation, one of the members of the Young Ones team on BBC Television, and the best comedy record of the year for Neil.
Well, thanks a lot. Sorry, Neil couldn't be here to do it, but... He's left a note. It says, "Dear British record industry, you are all wonkers." Oh, no, hang on. I think he must mean bonkers. And thanks a lot. That's it. Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay, so I want to talk about Hurdy Gurdy Mushroom Man, because I think that is Neil's masterpiece.
You mean the B-side?
Yes. I didn't realise until researching this, it wasn't on the original album. It was only on the cassette. So,
is that right?
Yeah, because you do a little cassette intro saying, "Go away, I've got nothing for you, but oh, you might as well listen to the B-side."
Yeah.
It's on the cassette, but like, was that never going to be part of the original album then? I guess that was recorded just for the single, and then later you did the rest of the album?
Yeah. I can't remember why it wouldn't have been on the album. Probably we didn't think it was very good.
Is this microphone working? Well, oh, sorry. Okay. 1, 2, 3. No, shut up.
One thing about looking at the YouTube comments for Hole in My Shoe is how many people mentioned the B-side. So I had this thing, I love the B-side.
And now I've had Yeah, a lot of people do. You know how jukebox used to have a jukebox, a real jukebox, had a record, and it would come go onto the machine. And, of course, that meant on vinyl that if you had a jukebox and you had Hole in My Shoe on the jukebox, you'd have the Beast.
Yeah.
When we were on tour, Simon Brint, who's on that, who's on Hurdy-Gurdy, Mushroom Man, and Roland Riveron, who are Raw Sex.
Raw Sex, yeah.
From French Saunders. So we'd be on tour and we'd be in Preston or something. And you'd put your pound in and then you could put Hurdy-Gurdy Mushroom Man on in the middle of a sort of tough up and watch the atmosphere go completely hippie. Everybody going, oh, wow.
Yeah, everyone loved it, yeah. There's a couple of comments on YouTube, actually. They're saying, absolutely brilliant. The grief is to get for putting this on the jukebox in the pub. That's from Bob. And Joanne says, I used to love to put this on the pub, make everyone mad. Ha, ha, ha.
So that's what everybody was doing.
It's obviously a thing, wasn't it? So making the album then, so once the singles are hit, was there always the intention to make an album, or was this a reaction to the song being such a big hit?
It was a reaction to being a big hit. And there was a lot of sort of, what should it be? Record company immediately think, oh, great, we've got a, you know, it would do an album. Let's just repeat the formula.
Mm.
But they wanted to do a load of other hits and songs the same way and do it easier without Dave's genius on it. You know, that they would immediately try and do that. And I just always use what would the character do, you know, with Neil and with my character, Nicholas Craig. You have to take it seriously if you want it to be funny. Think, well, the reason he works, because you think, well, what would he do if he's had a hit? He'd say, well, I'll do an album, but I only want to do my kind of songs. I'm not going to do the hot, terrible commercial stuff, you know. So we've got an incredible string band song on it. We've got a Donovan song on it. We've got a Caravan song on it. We've got Lentil Nightmare on it, but that's only because he eats a hamburger by mistake.
Lentil Nightmare is like, that's a genuine kind of like heavy metal. Are you doing the falsetto on that?
That's me doing all the singing.
Yeah. That's an amazing voice.
I can't do it now. I really high, isn't it? I mean, it's really high.
That's incredible singing. Rick Mayall's got a writing credit on that. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did he write
it? Does Aid have it too, a writing credit?
I think it's just Rick Mayall on that one.
Right. Yeah, can't remember. We must have been messing about. I'm having a Lentil Nightmare. It would have been the you know, in the lyric of the song, everything has gone black except for the lentils in the nightmare, and they're a sort of greeny, yellowy sort of a colour.
Yeah.
it's the demon lentil king with his phalanx of blood-crazed virgin riding on their motorbikes and do something else. I don't know which bits of that Rick wrote, but we must have had...
Was he there, like, when you were recording it, or was it just he'd given...
No, it already existed.
Okay.
Before we came, I brought it from something Rick and I, you know, mucked about with. And I said, well, let's do this. The thing that I brought it to the table, as it were, from what Rick and I had done. No, he wasn't there at the recording of the album.
And Stephen Fry's like the narration in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Do you think that got him the Harry Potter gig?
I'd like to think so, yes.
And though for long he had lain low in the quietness and in the darkness, now was the moment. And with one terrifying leap, he sprang out of the wardrobe, wearing nothing but his white pants and a pair of Wellington boots. And spying himself in the mirror, he ripped into one of the most amazing lead solos on the tennis racket since Jimi Hendrix on the Lulu Show. His machine heads glistening as he stood in
totally terrible, actually. It's been a really horrible experience. Goodbye. I'll see you like after the commercials and all the rest of that, you know.
And the side one.
Do you love British TV?
Do you love American accents?
I'm Kaylee McMahon.
I'm Stephanie Callis, and we would love for you to listen to our podcast, Anglophilia.
Each season, we discuss six different British comedies, some we've seen and some we've hardly heard of. We dare to ask important questions like, is there a porn version of Mr. Bean?
Are Viv and Mike from The Young Ones secret lovers?
Are Patsy and Adina bigger stoners than Cheech and Chong? And more.
Find Anglophilia on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or listen directly on our website, anglophiliapodcast.com.
Toodle pip.
What'd you call me?
Ah! Neil!
Oh, hi, Viv.
Still trying to save the world, eh, Neil? It's money that makes the world go round, not peace and love. You can't love your neighbour and make a decent profit.
Well, you can with friends provident, actually, Viv.
I'm talking serious money. Every man for himself. Friends who?
Friends provident. They're really big in ethical investment.
Ethical?
Yeah, they believe in keeping your money out of anything heavy.
Well, I suppose you stand to make a heavy profit, do you, Neil?
Well, actually, I already have, Vivian.
Well, how'd they manage it?
Talk to my breadhead.
Ask your breadhead about stewardship ethical investments from Friends Provident.
Item.
So, instead of a third series of Young Ones, you did Filthy Rich and Cat Flap. How did that compare as an experience? And in retrospect, do you think you would have been better doing a third series of Young Ones? Or do you think it was the right thing? The only thing you could do was do something fresh. Like you couldn't, like with Fawlty Towers, you couldn't top the first two series. You're doomed to fail if you try to top the first two series of Young Ones.
I mean, entirely in the hands of the writers, really. It's really what you get. Ben, Rick and Lisa were on writing together on the Young Ones. They were no longer, as I remember it, after the same, they were no longer going out together. So that would have been a bit of a problem, right? A third series of the Young Ones. And you couldn't exclude her from her own creation, but it would have been a bit vibey, I think.
Vibey, yeah.
For the three of them to carry on working together. That might have been a reason. I don't know. It's behind the writers, you know. Ben and Rick wrote some bits for Filthy Rich and Cat Flap. They were fairly disjointed. Ben, as usual, made a solid script, you know, absolutely worked so far. And I was claiming my character because Neil had been so massive. I wanted to surprise people. And so I spent some sessions trying to create my character and teaching him the language. There's I used to work in musicals. I worked in musicals for ages, and I knew a load of these old guys, you know, who were in the chorus, and they still kept this Polari language going, which is all Latin. Look at the Bonaroma, you know, Luby. Look at the Bonaroma. Look at the Latties on that Bonaroma. Like a Cockney rhyming slang is. And so I was feeding all this stuff to Ben.
Hope I'm not late, Lubies. Here, I bought you a bottle of wine, but I drank it in a taxi.
Oh, God, I forgot I'd invited you, filthy. You're hardly going to impress my showbiz friends.
I'd be impressed if you had any friends, Richie.
Right, that's it. I'm serious, that's it. Your invitation's withdrawn. Go away now.
Oh, go on, daughter. Do me a favour. Where's your sense of humour? Only a bijou jokette.
Who? Joke? Oh.
Of course I'll impress your friends. We'll make a boner little team. The financial artist.
The theatrical artist.
And the piss artist.
And he came up with the script. It was less of a gang doing Filthy Rich and Cat Flap. As you can see, you've got Rick and Aide beginning to sort of say, look, why don't we just do our own
thing?
Because they moved on to Bottom. And you got Ben, who by then was pretty successful after the two series of the Young Ones. You know, he was off doing Al Fresco. He was, you know, when he got invited to write with Curtis on Blackadder, shortly thereafter, or just around that time. So Ben was kind of quite grand by then, said, well, I'll come and write script for your series, sure, you know, but everything had sort of changed shape. So it was inevitable Also a really good idea, I thought. I love the idea that Rick's character was now Rich, who was a big showbiz celebrity. And he had his entourage, who was Eddie, and he had his agent. And so there was a lot of, it was slightly meta like they do nowadays, you know, because he had just been a celebrity. Yeah. It was a reaction to what's it like now? We're on telly. Oh, my God, what do we do now? So it was a reaction, you know. We've got to get the Nolans on, you know. So, yeah, I'd like to have done a second series of that.
When was the last time you saw it? Because I haven't seen it for years. I should check it out again.
I saw bits of it because I did one of these, like what I'm doing now. There's a new podcast, Podcasto Cat Flappo, and it's a sort of congregating for Filthy Rich and Cat Flap fans.
Really? It's a podcast of Filthy Rich and Cat Flap?
Yeah. Of their fans. Yeah, they're all, you know. And
they're a Young Ones podcast.
I don't know.
That'd be weird if there's a Filthy Rich and Cat Flap podcast, but not a Young One. That'd be bizarre. That'd be like having a Wings podcast and no Beatles podcast, wouldn't it? It'd be like...
I suppose so, yeah.
That's strange.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's like the Neil album. I think there's lots of little pockets of sort of fanatical people who really, really like this thing they've discovered.
Yeah.
Never quite went as mainstream as something else. I can understand that. I think it's quite nice because it is a bit weird. Filthy Rich Cat Flap is quite odd, isn't it?
Morning, Richie.
Morning, Eddie. What are you doing in my bed?
Well, I was sleeping, but now I'm talking to a kid.
Okay, so still in 84, there's footage of you at Band Aid.
Neil, yeah.
Yeah, so do you have any particular memories of that? And did you stay in character the whole time you were there? Were you there for the whole recording? Or just?
Yeah, I was. I deliberately turned up a little bit late because I was nervous. You know, in the big lineup when they're singing the song.
Yeah.
I'm not in that. And I turned, he said, oh, we start recording, be there by 3. And I was nervous. This is about starving people. And, you know, this is a serious matter. And I'm going to be the only person in a wig and a silly thing trying to get laughs. Standing in a chorus of people, there's the whole thing about, well, could Neil actually sing anyway? How's it going to work acting in character? There's a slight not fit. I did stay in character, yeah, but I turned up sort of just as they were finishing up the recording so that I couldn't get rode into it.
Right.
And hung about backstage while they went and did the next bit of the recording or the whatever, you know, and messed about with status quo. And we filmed, it was like Neil visits the recording of the thing, you know.
They wouldn't let me join in. They just wanted to be like a really heavy technological computerized single. I'm going to do my own one, okay? Neil's acoustic version of the Christmas single. Okay, here we go. Feed the world. Let them know it's Christmas.
Which was, I think I did right.
So you would have been in the chorus singing. That was the original.
Yeah, it wouldn't have worked.
I'd be really odd if you see Neil there singing, Do They Know It's Christmas? That would have been a bit, yeah.
It's not quite, you know, because the whole point of Neil is to be satirical, is to be funny, you know.
Yeah, that would have been a bit of a disconnect, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but then wandering around the studio saying, where's the gent? Can anybody get me out of here? I'm locked in and all that. That's fine.
Yeah.
The making of. I did the sort of the making of, you know. And it was fun, brilliant. I got to meet Paul Weller and, you know, all good.
Did you ask him what he thought about the lyrics? The bottom of my shoe.
No.
Look, everyone, he's coming through the doors.
Brilliant! He didn't even open them!
He's here!
Quick, Rick, do the speech.
Hey, kids, stop smogging and pay attention to me. Because if you're a wild-eyed loner standing at the gates of oblivion, then hitch a ride with us cos we're on the last freedom moped out of nowhere city, and we haven't even told our parents what time we'll be back. So pull on your dancing trousers and get down to the total and utter king of rock and roll, Cliff Richard!
Got myself a crack. Right, so next charity involvement was with Living Doll, which is 86. So what was the beginning of that and the getting back together the Young Ones? Were there any reservations about doing that?
No, I mean, that's just such good fun. I think it was Richard Curtis. Richard Curtis, he was just setting up Comic Relief, and it was the first thing Comic Relief did.
Mm.
Start. How did we get Young Ones together with Cliff Richard, who, of course, Rick Hero worships him. Why didn't we get them to do Living Doll? So we did, and it was the video took an afternoon with Paul Whelan, and can't remember who did the recording. We went down the studio, recorded our bits. Cliff was in for a very short space of time, did his bits, did his bit of video. It's all done and dusted pretty quick, really.
So when you recorded the song, was he with you when you recorded it, or did he come in separately, did his vocal, and then you do your bits separately?
I can't remember if it was on the same day. It might have been the next day. I think we'd done all our recording in the studio. And then we came back the next day to the studio so that we could film with Cliff doing the thing as he sang. And then we all went out in the park and did the bits out in the park. That's how I remember it. But, it's a long time ago. But it wasn't sort of weeks of effort.
Yeah.
And it was amazing having thought, I mean, it's such a strange combination, Utgard and Cliff that's odd. But then he came in. There is a moment, you're through the glass. We were in the control bar. You've got the glass. You've got Cliff Richard, the other side, goes to the mic, and he's been talking kind of, oh, gosh, seeming like it's, And then out comes his voice, and it's got that sort of velvet echo around it. It's Cliff. But it was everybody sort of was well impressed. It's a very rounded, fruity, lovely voice. And I don't know why that would surprise you, but you're sitting in the studio and then we heard him first start singing. We all go, oh yeah, that's what he's, that's a beautiful sound he makes. It's a lovely sound. Which was, yeah, it was quite strange because we just saw him as a butt of all of our jokes.
Yeah.
We thought of him as he was sort of mainstream parents pop sort of thing, And then you hear that voice, you think, oh no, he's got something.
Did he know who you were? Did he know who the Young Ones were?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And if he hadn't, he'd certainly done his research and caught up on it. So but it was, as I say, it wasn't a long association.
Can I go now?
Yes, thanks, Cliff. Bye. Right, kids, if you don't buy this record, then you're an utter, 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 utter.
Do you remember where you were when you found out it was number one? Were you listening to the chart rundown or?
I don't remember anything about it at all.
I remember getting a number one single.
Yes, I can remember that, but I can't, remember any celebrations. No, it's all gone. I mean, that period, there was so much happening all at once. I was so busy doing so many things that I can't remember particularly.
That's a sign of a good career if you can forget or not particularly remember getting a number one single. That's pretty good.
Well, I remember that it was, but I can't remember.
You remember that moment where you find out, yes, you were number one? It was no, like, kind of big, kind of, whoa.
No.
No? Okay, fair enough. Right, so you recorded the B-side, All the Little Flowers Are Happy, which is basically a six-minute sketch. So do you remember recording that? What the circumstances were? You don't remember
absolutely
that?
Absolutely no recall. Definitely.
The last kind of major sketch the Young Ones did.
Is it really? All the Little Flowers Are Happy?
Yeah, it's like a six-minute chat. Well, you have like in a conversation about recording a B-side and then you sing the little song at the end. You don't remember it at all?
Not at all.
Really?
I don't think I've ever heard it.
Neil! Give me your trousers.
No, get off. These are my trousers and I'm sticking to them.
Take off your trousers.
No, I can't. Vivian put super glue in them.
That was 3 years ago, Neil.
Well, how often do you change your trousers?
Don't worry, Neil. It isn't a problem. Taking trousers off is very easy.
Oh, yes, it is, except that I'm more used to taking off dresses.
What? You wear a lot of dresses, then, do you, Rick?
Yes, I do. No, that's not what I meant, Vivian, and you know it. All I'm saying is that girls find me terrifically sexy, and they often ask me to take their dresses off.
That is a complete and utter lie!
It is not! All right, then, look at my love bite.
That isn't a love bite. That's your bottom.
All right, then, what's it doing on my face?
That's not your face. What's it doing on my face?
Now, come on, guys.
I used that all the time when I had the single. Because it was basically like another Young Ones episode, like a 6-minute audio episode of the Young Ones. It's like,
I must listen to that. I've never.
It's really funny. It's really
absolutely
good.
Absolutely doesn't even ring a bell.
Really? You don't remember recording it? It was all four of you. You all recorded it together.
Yeah, I can remember the sort of weeks of that kind of improvising for the Bad News album.
Right.
When all four of us are in the studio, you know, doing Bad News.
Do you want to give it to me one more time?
Yes, it comes just after the piece, a bit actually.
No, don't play the fucking
I thought you
music
said give it to you one
time.
More time.
No, just his scream.
Ah!
No, not your scream. Colin's scream.
No, my scream comes after him.
All right, then.
Not right, my... So we'll do mine first.
All right. Well, why don't you go... Dan, why don't you go from the verse before that?
Oh, no,
that?
I was doing it so that you could...
No, no, but go from the verse before that, then I'll know where I am and what feeling I have. Nightmare... Look how I put on the light again. All that, yeah, la-di-la. Sing the words.
Nightmare!
That's it.
Here comes the beast again. Ah!
Did that predate Spinal Tap? I think it's around the same time, isn't it?
That's the uncanny thing. It's exactly the same time. I mean, the weirdest thing, because they came out, it was exactly the same time. They're in pre-production at the same time. Very strange.
We both had the same idea at the same time.
But it happens, doesn't it? I suppose.
Did you see Spinal Tap at the time? Did you watch it?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love that.
Yeah.
Ours is slightly different because we're crap and Spinal Tap were actually a good band. You know, they were a successful band and we weren't. So I find that's funnier. You know, I think we're funnier.
I always know a bit about your character. Wasn't it your character in Bad News?
Dennis.
The bit we're going about in the bloody sausages, little bloody
sausage.
Yeah.
Sausages, yeah.
Right, love. £2.05.
Right, where's the camera? Look, what's the name of this place? Well, anyway, it's a rip-off. Look, they're charging £2 for one bloody sausage. So don't come here.
You performed Comic Relief at the Shaftesbury Avenue Theatre with Cliff.
Yeah, yeah.
You have memories about doing that?
Yeah, there was a work because he was doing a show called Time.
Yeah, the hologram of Laurence Olivier. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and there was a worry he wasn't going to make it in time. And we had some very bad jokes about, oh, where's Cliff? He's doing time. And Neil's saying, oh, I don't know, you know, how many years did he get or whatever. I don't know. Mm. But that was such, that really is good fun. I think I'd. The memory I've got there is I had a sprained ankle, I think, broken ankle. So I was limping that day. But it's such fun. I've seen the video of that recently. You look back and think, that looks like they're all enjoying themselves. Audience are enjoying it. It looks like, the spark is there. It's all happening.
Some really heavy news about Cliff that's going to completely blow your mind. What's that smell?
Neil, go away.
Don't patronise me, you bastards. Oh, yeah. Let's all sit in rows and ruin Neil's evening.
So was that rehearsed? Because you said you weren't sure if he was going to turn up or not. So was there a rehearsal for that? Or was it just...
We all rehearsed. And he turned up and did it.
Right, okay.
No, we didn't get a chance to rehearse, as far as I remember.
Right.
Because he was in another show.
Thank you! It's really nice to be here. I realise
Trouser tonight. It's me that's the alternative. Take it away.
Was there any suggestion of, because it went so well, of bringing the young ones back for anything? Or was it just like always understood this is a one-off thing for charity and there's no...
People always asked, are you going to do another series? You know, bring it back with the old ones. And that's been, everyone always thinks that's a good idea. Actually, no, I did try once to, as I like. Now, who were the writers I thought could, for a comic relief special, I'm guilty, it was to Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong.
Okay, Peep Show.
We did Peep Show. Somebody said, I said, well, if we could, why don't we do a comics relief thing, like in something, I don't know, years ago or 20 years ago. And the only person, you know, but nobody, anyone want to write, they'd be written by somebody. And I was in communication with them. I was, so no, these guys could do it. These guys, there's not many people who could get the level of humour.
Mm.
But I think Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong definitely could. Jesse Armstrong now, of course, writing
Succession.
Yeah.
But nothing came of that.
No. I mean, in the end, you would look a bit sad. A load of sort of older fat.
That might have worked for a 5-minute comic relief sketch. That might have been quite funny, just to like, yeah.
Yeah. And well, that's the thing. If it was done properly, if it was written, say, by Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong, and it took into account the fact that we're rather sad on a fatter guy, then that would, you know, you could make that funny.
Yeah.
But trying to relive your old, you know, trying to do it the way you did before, that's a recipe for disaster.
And, of course, you did do it again because you did the American version, Oh No, Not Them.
Oh, no, not them, yeah.
Yeah, so it's never been seen, has it?
No, it hasn't.
Have you ever seen it?
I've seen it. In fact, I may remedy that soon. I think I can get hold of a copy.
Really? Because I would love to see it, because it sounds like a... Because there was no Rick, right? Neil was the only
Neil was the only... And then they took... a great guy, Rob Bundy, who turned into a friend of mine, play a sort of preppy version of Mike, who was sounding enthusiastic, nice. He was a sort of blend of Mike and Rick.
Right.
And then they chose this actor who'd been in a wonderful film about bicycling, whose name I can't remember, to play Viv the punk. And they had a few bikini-clad girls around.
Obviously, yeah.
And I said, look, isn't it, this is a bit Benny Hill, you know. And they went, that's great.
That's what they want, of course. Was it based on any of these specific episodes of The Young One?
It was a mishmash. No, it was. It had bits of all sorts. It had, I had the arms, many arms, which I had a thousand pair of hands, that did. It had the bomb landing in the living room, which comes from a different episode. It was a mishmash. It was pretty faithful. The guy was great, actually, Dave Merkin. He loved it too much, in a way. Right. He should have possibly tried to make it more American and slick because he was too faithful and the Americans didn't understand what the hell. And he went on to write and produce The Simpsons.
There you go.
And he'd written before doing this, he was Bob Newhart's main writer, but it had every chance of becoming something. It just fell between American and English, really.
So was Neil exactly the same in it, the character?
Yeah, and they bullied him the same. And but I had to play with more energy. Like at the end of the episode, there's a shootout. They get some guns and they all decide to shoot. Playing with guns. And then they go, oh, we're stupid. We've learned that we can be our own worst enemies. There's a mistake. It was funny. It's not bad. Well, it is bad, actually. it doesn't work as a whole.
But you do a Neil with lots of energy, though, do you? That's kind of like...
It's a different sort of Neil, yeah. I mean, he was the same Neil, but it wasn't... That sort of English, I don't know, just kind of letting everything drop into sort of low energy and just, you know, oh, I think I might as well kill myself kind of. You know, he did. I had to move around a bit more. You know?
Right.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see in the titles, music and claymation is by the same guy who did the music for The Simpsons.
It's Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's almost like The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And they all go, and then they all come in and they land on the sofa.
On the sofa, right. Okay, so it's exactly the same.
But it's claymation. Yeah, I think it was just ahead of its time because American audiences just couldn't.
Yeah,
couldn't. You know, why is everything so? You know, they don't get the. We, I suppose, like things. It's not just irony. We like things to be crap. Things to be negative.
Yes, being British, we delight in crapness, don't we? It's like
negativity and absolutely. Just kind of pissed off.
Hating each other and, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All the negative.
And somehow the Americans, you know, with the and this guy, Dave Merkin, was just such a fan of British comedy. He really knows it back. And a great joke writer. But somehow it didn't hit the spot.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Hopefully I'll see the light of day because I'd love
to. Yeah, it'd be good, wouldn't it?
I would love to see that.
Aetisography, quick fire round.
Did you keep any of Neil's wigs?
Well, I had one made for the tour for my own work, and I ended up giving that one away. There was a charity, a rock and roll charity auction of some sort, and I gave his wig, his guitar, his shoes with the holes in, and his big greatcoat.
Oh,
well,
yeah, yeah.
Whole outfit. I don't think they got very much, actually. But anyway, so they're gone.
They're gone, it's all gone.
Yeah.
When was the last time you saw Rick Mayall?
That's nobody's ever asked me that. I think it was down at Peter Richardson's, because they were neighbours in the end, in Devon. And there was some do or other down in the country. I think that's the last. I think. I had a meal with him. We worked together. The last time we actually worked together was on a film called Sex, actually, which is a comic strip film with Robert Bathurst in it and Rebecca Front, I think. And I play some pervert. And Sharon Smith's in it. It's one of the lesser comic strip films. Mm. And Rick was in that. And afterwards, we thought, oh, we must, you know, let's see if we can throw some ideas around, and we went for a meal, and he was behaving most extravagant, you know, still showing off in the restaurant, being like, you ring him up after not speaking to him for many years. Oh, he doesn't know it's you, because this is before Mobile. Mm-hmm. Hello, Rick Mayall, international celebrity. Okay. And he
that's
never
what you want, so, isn't it? That's what you want. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he would. I mean, he'd never let it drop, you know. So it didn't turn into a serious meeting about ideas we could have.
Yeah.
It was just Rick doing, you know, being Rick and being the entertainment of the day. Yeah, it's sad.
It's a really sad loss. I think for my generation, when Rick Mayall died, it was just such a, you know, it's almost like the end of an era thing. Losing Rick. Obviously, it would have meant a lot more to you personally. But do you have a favourite line of Neil's from The Young Ones?
I did. It was in the tip of my tongue. Was that one when he goes, no, it's gone. No. Una Stubbs.
Una Stubbs.
I love it when they say we're going to have Una Stubbs. And Neil just goes, oh, Una Stubbs.
Yes, this girl's like, Una Stubbs! Una Stubbs!
Because I knew Una Stubbs, and she was a wonder. And I love the way Neil is sort of in love with Una Stubbs.
Do you actually own copies of the singles, by the way? That was a question I meant to ask you earlier.
You mean like vinyl?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've, as I said, I've been going through my archive. I've got a book which has been crowdfunded on unbound.com called Jeremiah Born in Time that I've written, and you get the you crowdfund and you get a reward, like an advanced copy of the book signed, you get your name. And I've been just getting rid of all the stuff in my cupboards, and I've given away copies of Neil's Book of the Dead and the 12-inch single and the 6-inch single and also Bad News stuff and a lot of memorabilia stuff. It's all, I'm sort of, you know, divesting all this stuff. So, well, the book's 100% funded now, but I think you can still pledge. Yeah, there's all sorts of singles still. I've still got much too much stuff in there. I'm just still trying to get rid of stuff in there.
Your biggest professional disappointment of the 80s?
In the 80s, I suppose I was doing a series called Roll Over Beethoven. I did Shine on Harvey Moon for Martin Grant, who are these great comedy writers. Three series of that. And then they put me in the main role in this thing, bland mainstream, but it was nice.
Well, shall we get straight on down and do that funky thing then?
Don't you think we ought to stick to music?
Yeah, that's what I meant. I mean, what do you think I meant?
Oh, nothing. It's just, you know, the thing. Things one reads about you pop people, yeah.
What's he been saying about me? There's all that stuff about Bangkok and the baby clams. That is total lies, right?
And it clashed with some of our young ones tour or some, there was some, can't remember, so comic strip or young ones thing that was clashing, and they had to make a choice. And I chose to go with, you know, with the gang, with the comedians. But I still think, oh, do you know what? I could have been an ordinary actor. I could have been in that thing. It could have been, I really liked them. A bit of a shame that I was unable to do it. And we did the first series, and then they wrote my character out of the second series.
Okay, what was your best professional moment of the 80s? There's one single moment you can think, I want to go back to that moment right now. What would it be?
Hole in My Shoe. Probably making that psychedelic video with Steve Black. Because it was like, you mean I can actually do a proper psych? I mean, it was filmed by Nigel Cole, who's since become a great comedy film director. And we just agreed. He's a muso as well, Nigel Cole. And we just agreed and said, well, let's do it not like an MTV. Let's actually really psychedelic, as in we're on acid. Let's do it like that, like a real proper thing. And the joy of being able to, being in a position where you can do what you want like that rather than have it into a TV form. And that's just so fun to say, no, I remember when I was 18 or 18, I remember everybody's faces went pink and went green and the grass was pink. You know, I can remember all of that stuff. That's how old I am.
Yeah.
I remember the real experience, 1973. I can remember that. So let's film it. And it's now 1983. Let's film it and do it. And that was, I think, a freedom that you've got. You know, I've got a hit record. We can relive the early 70s.
Living the dream.
The Eternal Jukebox.
Okay, you get to keep for all eternity either Living Doll or Hole in My Shoe or any Neil track. What's the one track you'd want to keep?
If it was down to Living Doll or Hole in My Shoe.
Yeah.
Hole in My Shoe would win.
Yeah.
It's much better. Not just for me, but for what Dave did on it. It's amazing. But that Donovan's Hurdy Gurdy Man, not Hurdy Gurdy Much, that version that Dave did of Donovan's Hurdy Gurdy Man with Neil singing on it.
Yeah.
Is a really beautiful thing, and it's lovely, lovely piece. So I'd probably choose that.
Okay, good choice. And finally, as my daughter screams, three words to describe your 80s.
Stressed, busy, fun. Yeah.
This is the end of the interview. Thank you very much.
Massive thanks to Nigel for a great interview and also Sean for helping to set it up. And if you aren't from the UK and have never watched Young Ones, I cannot recommend it enough. It still stands up and is still very funny. And if you do like the Young Ones, I do recommend Anglophilia podcast, which there's an advert for in the middle of the episode. They have covered the Young Ones. They basically, it's two American, basically Steph and Kayleigh go through British sitcoms and British culture. They did a Young Ones episode
done Blackadder, Father Ted, Fawlty Towers, a whole season on Monty Python. And yeah, it's one of the funniest podcasts out there. And it's worth listening to for their impression of Nicolas Cage doing Basil Fawlty. It's very funny. So hi, Steph. Hi, Kaylee. And I will upgrade and get better quality interviews. And if you want to help, because it's the wrong time to get a PayPal account. My timing always sucks. But think of it as if you want to help, you'll be supporting me, not rewarding them. And I'm not going to go for the hard sell again. I'll get Neil to do it for me.
Darling fascist bully boy, give me some more money, you bastard. May the seed of your loin be fruitful in the belly of your woman. Neil.
So yeah, see if you'd like to help. That's paypal8isography@gmail.com. I think I might need a new microphone soon as well. Someone's on the blink. So to end, it has to be the Neil masterpiece and the scourge of many an 80s pub jukebox. Hurdy-gurdy Mushroom Man. And the album, Neil's heavy concept album, is definitely worth a listen. And this you'll find this track at the very end. And it's just all you need. So all yours, Neil.
It's finished, okay? Go away! Stop listening! You're spoiling the whole atmosphere. That was supposed to, like, you know, be like a really atmospheric end. It's supposed to stop here, right? Well, I could play you the B-side of my single. That was quite good. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Finger cymbals. Yeah. Penny whistle solo. Jug. Yeah. Okay, now everybody shut up, okay? Because now comes the verse bit. Hurdy-gurdy mushroom man has locked me in a frying pan, and everybody laughs at me, the frozen scarecrow in the sea. And all the fishes swim away and say, don't hassle us today. And will my auntie come for tea? And people come and hassle me and try and stop me doing it as if I didn't know it. Shit. Shall we go on to the next bit now? Fluffy hair on a polar bear means more to me than a lavatory. You can't go far in a motor car with my front door key. Anyone and everything is everywhere is anyone is. Anything is everyone is anywhere is anything. Take my hand in a magic van and we'll take a trip over seven seas. Just a guy and a beauteous chick and a tropical disease. La 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 la. Everybody, oh, amazing, do anything. No, like when I said do anything, you know, I meant do anything except that. No, actually, it's all gone a bit weird now. No, look, can we have slightly less children? Because it's all getting too commercial. Horribly wrong. It's all sounding like white sugar. It's all gone too sugary, soppy. Couldn't we just keep it like a whole earth acoustic band? That was the worst experience I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
That's really great.
Vivian. Eating my underpants is even better than eating my blouse. You're not kidding.
Yeah!
Because he does his stupid nose.
Something hair on a polar bear means more to me than a lavatory. You can't go far in a motor car with my front door key.
All the little flowers are singing. All the little birds are tooting. Everything in the garden is happy. And we hope you are too. If you're happy, we're happy. If you're sad, we're sad. But now it's time to end this song, cause it's so bad.
Good night, children.
Good night.
Hello, good night.
Pass the detonator.
Shanker.